Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today I want to talk about something that's quite personal to me, and I hope for the medical community becomes quite personal in 2024 and onward. As mentioned before, this upcoming year is going to see unprecedented turmoil in health policy, and we as physicians and the broader medical community must work together to ensure that the rights of patients, healthcare providers, physicians included, are protected. And we cannot do that unless we're actively involved in the legal proceedings. That's why I want to discuss something that I have been doing for many years that I would now like to discuss with you all in hopes that my expertise can serve as an inspirational force for you to get involved. And that is writing amicus curiae briefs. Now, I'm pronouncing that correctly, even though when you Google it, it may sound like a little bit different, but I want to first start by talking about what is an amicus brief. Well, an amicus brief are filed by people who typically take the position of one side in a case. So they're legal documents. And they're submitted to the courts, not necessarily in favor of one side or the other, one litigant versus the other, but more in terms of supporting a cause that has some bearing on the case itself. So, for example, let's say Company X sues the FDA because the FDA is requiring unprecedented amount of clinical data to approve a drug that Company X is trying to promote. Well, we're not the FDA and we're not Company X, so we don't really have a horse in a race per se. But the key factor is that how the judges in that case make the ruling will then determine how that law can be applied in the future. And while that particular case may not affect you, the way the ruling took place will. And we see that over and over when it comes to abortion, opioids, vaping, gun control. It's less about the individual ruling in that case and more about the broad application of the law for health policy as a whole. Now, you may ask yourself, why as a physician or a member of the medical community do I need to start writing legal briefs? Shouldn't the legal system already know what to do sensibly for the clinical world? Well, I mean, I think the recent years have already answered that question, so we don't need to get into it too much. But I think we know for a fact that many judges rule on health conditions or health policy without looking at solely the clinical considerations. And what that means is that many judges will incorporate certain degrees of moralization or subjective beliefs into healthcare cases that appear before them. So they may have some level of the clinical insight, but they may bring in other factors into the fold as well. And together, that biased perspective may not be necessarily in the best interest of all patients. I want to talk about a personal case that I was involved in back in 2020. Now, this was the first amicus brief that I wrote, and I think that it's very important to go over it in a little detail because it'll help explain how I recognize the power of amicus briefs and why I encourage so many of you to start writing them in 2024 onward. This was for the Walmart v. DOJ case, and it appeared in the Sherman Division of the Eastern District of Texas, and I had submitted it in November 14, 2020. Effectively, Walmart was suing the Department of Justice, claiming that the Department of Justice was investigating the company without providing proper cause or explaining what it was investigating. Now, this was part of the broader overarching theme in which the federal government, state AGs, and namely the Department of Justice, in particular certain federal prosecutors, were going after opioid manufacturers, opioid distributors, and in this case, opioid retail pharmacies like Walmart, claiming that they didn't, quote-unquote, monitor the red flags that would have prevented the diversion. So in a legal sense, what the Department of Justice was investigating was Walmart's inability to maintain proper oversight in determining who was abusing their opioid prescriptions and who wasn't. Now, We know that's a near impossible task, and the Supreme Court, in cases like Ruan v. United States, has already ruled that intent is a major factor, but again, this was 2020, before 2022. I know the time horizon doesn't seem like that long, but in the world of health law, particularly as we saw in Roe v. Wade, things change fast. So as clinicians and people in the broader healthcare community, we need to jump on the moving train to ensure that as the law starts to change and the legal interpretations start to come out, they're in the best interest of the broader healthcare community. So going back to this case, the Sherman Division, East Texas, District of Texas, I filed an amicus brief, not siding with the Department of Justice, nor siding with Walmart, but the second and third degree factors that come into play when evaluating whether a patient merits an opioid prescription. Often when the DEA implements these red flag provisions, I'm not even going to call them laws because they're not, these red flag provisions, it usually comes down to looking at a patient's socioeconomic status and therefore their insurance coverage or lack thereof, their criminal history, which may be completely independent of their medical history, and other factors like how far they had to drive to go see their physician and whether they're taking other medical conditions. Now, there's a plethora of clinical literature that has shown that these are self-fulfilling prophecies. Effectively, you find what you are looking for. So if you're trying to essentially typecast a patient to be a drug seeker, you will find certain risk factors that will then justify that decision. But you're not really investigating. You're simply justifying a preconceived notion about a patient. And we don't need to go into the clinical literature about that because that has been proven over and over by people who are far more versed in this field than I am. My main focus is to say that as a primary care physician with no legal expertise, I was able to submit an amicus brief helping the court understand how they should adjudicate upon this matter. It's critical for you as a physician who may not have legal expertise but may have clinical training in abortion, clinical training in addiction medicine, clinical training on public policy and trauma as it pertains to gun violence. That expertise is very important because it informs how you will write the legal brief. Now, up until this point, I haven't really talked about how to construct an amicus brief. I mostly talked about its importance. Now I want to talk about the actual structure itself. And the funny thing is, there is no real structure. What I'm asking you in the medical field to do is to write a non-traditional amicus brief. Now, for those in the legal profession, those who are barred lawyers, there is a certain format by which an amicus brief is written. Certain case laws, meaning certain previous legal decisions that go into the amicus brief, are all accounted for, and then the legal theory is then expounded upon. We don't need to do that because we're not lawyers, nor are we trying to be lawyers. Instead, we are trying to bring our subject matter expertise as clinicians into the legal world. That entails writing a non-traditional, narrative-based amicus brief. Some will focus on the clinical studies and expound upon how the clinical studies can inform the concept of rights. Now, this is something very important because it's not quite understood in the legal world or the medical world, but it's this amorphous space that really determines how healthcare is applied in health law. Operates on this notion of rights. I, as a patient, have a right to informed consent. I have a right to be treated fairly and a right to assume liabilities for undue damage that's done to me in the course of my clinical care. These are all rights that are assigned. Some are rights with criminal punitive measures. Some are rights with civil punitive measures, but they're rights. And the way the law works is that it determines whether a right was infringed upon or not and what is the consequences of that infringement. As a physician, you have a right not to be harassed by a patient. You have a right to make clinical decisions that you believe are in the best interest of your patient. Those rights cannot be infringed upon. Now, whether they are or not is another question, but theoretically, in the concept of law as it should be applied, those are rights that, as physicians, you are protected with. But it's not that easy to apply that logic when you're dealing with complex clinical conditions. Like, should I have removed that stent on that patient given certain risk factors that I've felt warranted the removal? Well, the risk factors that you reviewed to make that decision is not necessarily the risk factors that other people would look into when they're determining whether that decision was justified or not. So there's clinical ambiguity in any decision that's made. Now, we as physicians know that. Healthcare is immersed in uncertainty. Every clinical decision is made with some degree of unknown, yet we move forward in proceeding with clinical care. That's essentially the concept of developing a differential diagnosis. You're taking certain symptoms, you're taking certain signs, identifying the patterns that correlate all the symptoms and signs together, and discerning what the diagnosis could be. But you never know for sure, yet you proceed nevertheless. And that particular ambiguity is almost anathema in the legal system. What they try to do is simplify things into rights. So as clinicians, you're balancing the complexity of medicine with the tendency to standardize and simplify in laws. And by putting those together, you're helping the court understand how to distill complex concepts of uncertainty in medicine into the standardized rubric of law. And that's why amicus briefs are important, and that's why as physicians writing briefs, there's no real set format because it's still an evolving science. Into a legal brief is up to you. But the fact that you are doing this and a judge is reading it has a positive influence on the legal outcome, and two, on future legal outcomes that'll be impacted by that decision. So when I write amicus briefs, what I like to do is focus on how the application of the law is influenced by its interpretation. As I like to phrase it, the interpretation of the law determines its application, and the implementation affects the most disenfranchised in the worst way possible. So what I encourage the judges to do is to look at second and third degree consequences for any law or adjudication, meaning any legal interpretation of the law. Now, you as a physician may think that I should focus on the clinical fundamentals when I write a brief, or I should review and present certain clinical data to help the judges. And all that's fair and good. But you have to understand that you're dealing with folks with little to no clinical training. Yes, there are advanced law degrees, what's known as an LLM, in health law, but very few judges actually have those advanced degrees. And it's not required for federal and state judges overseeing health law cases to have that advanced degree. So you're dealing with people who have as much medical knowledge in a formal setting as the average American on the street. Now, that's not to speak disparagingly about America's overall general knowledge, but it's to say that you're dealing with people that don't have specialized subject matter expertise. So if we talk about clinical study methodologies, a judge is just going to pass it off to his or her clerk and not read it. But if you phrase the medical concepts in a way that's more philosophical and more applicable in the legal setting, a judge will gravitate towards it. So I'm going to start by reading a few excerpts of the amicus brief that I submitted in 2020, and we can go over why that's helpful for you as you start to cultivate ideas on developing your own amicus briefs. So this is how I begin. I write to you on behalf of all my patients representing a civil complaint. My interests reside in the well-being of my patients throughout Northwest Indiana who have filed prescriptions for medications classified by the Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, as controlled substances, and who are either denied their medically necessary prescriptions or faced undue discrimination while filing their prescriptions, either explicitly or implicitly due to their physical appearance, their particular mannerisms, or their medical history. So right away, I begin the amicus brief by determining who I am and why I'm writing this. None of the patients were represented in this case. Again, it was Walmart and the Department of Justice. But my patients were indirectly affected because many of my patients go to Walmart in the Northwest Indiana region to fill their prescriptions. And as the Department of Justice was shown to be doing, they were using discriminatory profiling of patients to then discern legal liability on Walmart by saying Walmart didn't do enough to oversee the prevention of diversion. But the way the Department of Justice was asking Walmart to prevent diversion was effectively discriminatory in nature. And that's why I wanted to focus on my patients. And I end the first paragraph by saying their physical appearance, their particular mannerisms, and their medical history. And then I go on to say, and I write to ensure that the clarifications that come from the civil action address the undue burdens imposed upon physicians and patients who are and have been disproportionately affected by the opioid epidemic, ensuring the clarifications recognize that law adjudicating healthcare cannot be restrictive in nature. Rather, it must be affirmative in nature, maintaining a Madisonian balance between individual liberties and responsibilities and the common good and social welfare. Now, I kind of get on my high horse a little bit when I use the word Madisonian because I'm referring to our founding father, Madison, and his concept of triangulation, meaning a law should balance all the good and all the bad and not impose undue burdens on individuals by compromising individual rights for the sake of the common good. And vice versa, not compromise the common good for the sake of individual rights. But inherent in that, underlying all the legal rhetoric, was this notion that laws should be fair, their legal interpretations should be fair, and they should balance individual rights with broader social good. Now, I included this brief in the comment sections, and I also attached an ensuing legal document known as a motion for leave in the comment section as well. I'll go over what that additional document is, but I wanted to focus more on the amicus brief for now before I go into the nuts and bolts of submitting an amicus brief, which is more procedural in nature. I want to talk more about the structure and content of an amicus brief. One of the things you'll notice as you're going through this brief is that it reads like a philosophy essay. Now, who is a physician to write philosophy in the court of law? Well, going through the past few years, you can see that when it comes to Roe v. Wade, when it comes to vaping or gun control, we're starting to see philosophical arguments justify certain legal rulings. And so we as clinicians and part of the broader medical community have to apply that same philosophical framework in the court of law. And the nice thing about that is when we go in that direction, more philosophical, we aren't bounded by certain legal rhetoric or certain procedural requirements that you'll see in more traditional amicus briefs. We're essentially free to effectively create a narrative or an expository on what we believe to be key pertinent medical issues. So for me, I wanted the judges to understand that clinical care balances the individual with the broader good. And if you think about that, that's really the essence of medicine. Every medication that we prescribe, whether that's lisinopril for blood pressure or metformin for diabetes, has certain benefits and has certain side effects. We discuss the side effects, we minimize the side effects, and we focus on the benefits, but both are there. In the same vein, anything in healthcare has a net positive so long as we balance what is good and bad. And if the net positive turns into a net negative, we immediately recognize that there's more bad than good. So I want people to understand that when they're writing these briefs, make it philosophical, make it theoretical, because if you make it too dense, too scientific, too clinical in terms of research methodology, you're going to lose the judge. You're going to lose your intended audience. Now, the purpose of writing an amicus brief is to get the judge to think in a conceptual manner that aligns with your clinical beliefs. Now, let's talk about the elephant in the room, which would be abortion. Abortion has many complicating factors. One thing that is undeniable is that in the legal world, it is looked at non-clinically. And that is a problem, because when you start to look at healthcare outside of its traditional clinical format, you start to, as I mentioned earlier, introduce moralizations and subjectivity. So a lot of times people who have particular views on abortion will introduce legal rhetoric with religious connotations, or talk about certain antiquated notions like quickening, which was a 16th and 17th century concept where if you felt the belly of a pregnant patient and felt a kick, a quickening, then abortion was automatically considered illegal. Now, whether that was a perceived or real perception, who knows? But these are the type of tests or rubrics that were used in the court of law to essentially impose penalties upon women who were trying to get an abortion. Now, as a physician or an OBGYN specialist who may have a vested interest in protecting abortion rights or access to abortion, you have to convince somebody who is not clinically trained to see things the way you see them. Second order consequences, to know personal anecdotes, obviously de-identified, but to go over patient vignettes, go over clinical journeys with patients that you've endured, that personalizes the adjudication of a given law in the minds of physicians, in minds of judges, rather. And that's important because judges are not entirely objective. There's a certain degree of subjectivity that goes into any legal decision, and that's not a controversial statement. That's simply recognizing that judges are humans and make decisions by weighing all of the facts presented to them in a certain way. That's inherently subjective. So why not put your clinical context in the mix to help the judge look at certain health issues a certain way? When it comes to abortion, help judges understand the consequences of a certain ruling and how that affects the most disenfranchised patients. So what I'm going to do is, in the coming weeks, start uploading amicus briefs that I've written in recent years and share that with the Daily Remedy audience and the broader medical community so that you can see how non-traditional amicus briefs are accepted in courts and hopefully get a sense of the net positive effects that they've had. I want to conclude by talking about something more procedural in nature, and that's how to submit an amicus brief. Now, if you see in the sections, comment sections, you'll see that there's two documents, right? There is the actual brief itself, and then there is what's known as a motion for leave. A motion for leave is a procedural document that you have to submit to the court where you want to have your amicus brief accepted. So from a step-by-step procedural standpoint, the first thing you'd have to do is draft your amicus brief. The second thing you would have to do is draft what's known as a motion for leave. And I'll have templates of motion for leave documents that I'll upload and give to those who are interested. This motion effectively validates in the minds of the court that there's no opposition to the amicus brief that you're submitting. Now, the reason why you need something like this is to prevent people from submitting outlandish amicus briefs that may say things that are factually incorrect or may put one of the litigants in the case at undue harm. So the motion for leave essentially verifies that the amicus brief that's being submitted truly is an amicus brief, meaning it's an independent third-party document that's used for the court's benefit, not for the benefit of any one litigant. Now, obviously, there's going to be a certain sidedness. Nobody submits something to court for the purely objective sense without having some bias or some sidedness. But the intent of the document overall should be to help the court make a decision, not so much to help one specific party over the other, even though that's an unintended consequence of submitting a document and having a certain perspective. So this motion for leave has to be approved by all the litigants. Now, typically what will happen in a class action lawsuit, like when the Purdue Pharma case, where they filed a Chapter 11 bankruptcy under Judge Drain in the Southern District of New York, there's one representative for all the sides, and you have to get the approval of that one representative, who will then acknowledge and say, I have no opposition to this motion, submit it. Now, what I found is that prosecutors, particularly federal prosecutors, don't like to talk to physicians. But if I get a clerk of the court to help me with the motion for leave and CC that particular contact on the emails requesting any opposition or acceptance of the motion for leave, all of a sudden the prosecutors, the litigants, whomever, are more quick to respond. Now, that's kind of a pro tip that I had to learn the hard way. What I was finding is that when I would ask if any individuals had opposition to my motion, nobody would respond. I would just get non-responses or straight ghosted. But when I went to the clerk and asked him or her for help in completing the motion for leave and asking them, can I CC you on the email send out? All of a sudden now, in the minds of the prosecutor, in the minds of the litigants, there's a clock. That clerk knows an email has been sent requesting any opposition or lack thereof for this motion for leave. So the likelihood of you as a physician writing a non-traditional amicus brief, if you include the clerk in the email send out, the likelihood of you getting a response is much higher than it would be otherwise. So I recommend you doing that. And again, for those who are interested, I can go step by step and guide you through the entire process of drafting the amicus and going through the process of submitting the amicus. Now, typically there won't be much opposition, particularly if you're writing a non-traditional, clinically oriented amicus brief, for two reasons. One, it's an unfamiliar format, so the litigants are probably not going to spend too much time looking at it. And two, if you're writing something that's clinically sound, it's in nobody's best interest to go and oppose that. For example, if you write an amicus brief on an abortion case and you talk about the clinical fundamentals of abortion, nobody's going to oppose that. And if they do, they're just damaging themselves. So you're going to benefit if you write something that's clinically sound and keep it within the confines of clinical medicine, because the type of opposition will be minimal to none. Really, the only opposition will come from actually getting that motion for leave. So once you have the motion for leave and you have your amicus brief, then you submit it to court. Now, every court system has a specific submission process, particularly for non-traditional amicus briefs. I can help you find contacts in the court clerk's office to go through the submission process, but it's very important that you follow their rules for submission so that they can accept the amicus and that you can have validation from the court itself that you have successfully submitted an amicus brief. When I wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court case Ruan v. United States, I received a receipt of acknowledgement from the Solicitor General. And that was their way of validating my submission. Typically, you'll see a confirmation document in the lower courts, meaning the district or appellate courts, for the amicus in question, the 2020 Walmart v. DOJ case, I've also included the confirmation of for the motion for leave as well. So you can see all the documents that are necessary. So you'll need the amicus brief, the motion for leave, and the confirmation from the courts that they accept the motion for leave and accept the amicus brief. All of that together encompasses the process of submitting an amicus brief. And I know it can be daunting, particularly for those in the clinical field who last wrote an essay in high school English or college English class, and only recent writing experience comes from writing peer-reviewed academic studies. But remember, your involvement in these legal cases is the most direct way that you can influence how judges rule on prominent health cases. And there are a slew of major health law cases coming up in 2024 during an election year in which the political rhetoric is already at a peak. We have to make sure that health law reflects patient care in the best interest of the patients. And one of the most effective ways we can do that is by writing amicus briefs and putting ourselves in the courtroom so that the judges have to adjudicate upon the legal framework presented in the case by taking clinical context into account. So if there's any questions or anybody's interested in submitting an amicus brief, please get a hold of me. Please submit something in the comment section so I know who you are, and then we can find a way to connect offline. And with that, I thank you for your time, and I hope that this video helps you and inspires you to write amicus briefs, because we need more clinical input in the field of healthcare adjudication.